Picture this, a massive freight train, miles long, thundering across the vast expanse of North America. It's a familiar sight, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Hard to miss.
Yet beneath that powerful, often unseen presence lies the very backbone of a continent's economy. These titans of logistics are shaping everything, you know, from the food on your table to the car in your driveway.
Absolutely. Moving immense quantities of goods. Quietly and relentlessly, just keeping our modern world running.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're pulling back the curtain on this vital, fascinating sector, the North American freight rail industry.
Yeah, we've been sifting through a pretty detailed investment analysis, lots to unpack.
Exactly. We want to uncover the most important insights, maybe some surprising facts, and definitely the strategic shifts that are defining this industry right now.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission is really to give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed about a sector that impacts, well, virtually every aspect of modern life.
And it's a good time for it because there are some major changes underway.
Right. We're seeing this new wave of consolidation, incredibly sophisticated operational models, and a critical evolving role in global trade.
And that proposed merger, Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern, that's huge.
That's the big one. It could fundamentally redraw the map of North American logistics. We'll definitely be pulling on that thread throughout our discussion, exploring how it changes everything. Let's get into it.
Sounds good. It's an incredibly dynamic time for an industry that, you know, often feels very traditional.
Yeah.
The rail sector right now is like a crucial economic barometer. And honestly, it's flashing some really interesting, almost contradictory signals about the health of the broader economy.
Okay, so we started with the sheer power of these trains, but the tracks themselves are whispering a complex story right now. A fascinating, almost contradictory tale about the broader economy.
Uh-huh.
The North American rail industry in mid-2025 is definitely a study in contrast, isn't it?
That's a perfect way to put it.
On one hand, you have this incredible resilience, while on the other, there's clear softness. What exactly are the rails revealing?
Well, what we're seeing is a clear divergence, a split, really, between two primary segments of rail traffic, carloads and intermodal.
Okay.
Carload traffic, that involves your bulk and merchandise commodities like chemicals, grain, industrial products. That segment has shown continued strength.
How strong?
Well, total U.S. rail carloads in the second quarter of 2025 were up a significant 4.8% compared to the prior year. That's actually the largest quarterly percentage gain in nearly 4 years since Q3 2021.
Wow, okay.
And year-to-date, through the first 30 weeks, U.S. carloads have increased by a solid 2.7%.
That's pretty robust growth. What sectors are really driving that strength in carloads, and what does that tell us about the broader economy?
It points to a pretty firm footing in the industrial economy. We're seeing sectors like chemicals, grain posting record or near-record volumes. Mm-hmm. Even coal, which, you know, has been in a long-term secular decline, has experienced a surprising short-term rebound in carloads.
Really? Coal.
Yeah, but the insight here is you got to look beyond the surface. It's less about coal suddenly making a comeback and more about how much a really weak prior year can flatter the current numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, favorable comparisons.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. It's a good reminder for anyone analyzing cyclical industries. Mm-hmm. Always dig deeper than the headline number.
Exactly. Always check the base year.
So industrial production, chemicals, agriculture, all looking pretty healthy based on that. But then you mentioned a contrast. Where are we seeing the softening?
In stark contrast, yeah. It's intermodal traffic. That's the movement of shipping containers and truck trailers, which is largely tied to consumer goods and international trade.
Right, the stuff you buy online or in stores.
Pretty much. And that segment has shown clear signs of softening. After a record-setting 2024, U.S. rail intermodal originations actually fell 2.9% in June 2025.
Okay. A decline. How significant is that?
Well, it's notable because it was the first year-over-year monthly decline in 22 months.
What's causing that stumble?
It seems to be a combination of factors. Broader uncertainties in global supply chains, definitely a cooling in consumer demand for goods, people maybe shifting spending back to services.
That'd be.
And critically, intense price competition from a soft trucking market. Trucking rates have been low.
Ah, So trucks are cheaper right now, pulling some business away.
Potentially, yeah, on the margins. But it's important to note, despite this recent dip, year-to-date intermodal volumes through week 30 are still positive. They're up 4.8% overall for the year so far.
Okay, so the long-term trend might still be intact?
Yeah.
Despite these near-term headwinds?
That's what it suggests. The fundamental reasons for intermodal growth haven't disappeared, but there's definitely some near-term pressure.
So this bifurcated rail volume data, with strong carloads but soft intermodal, it sounds like it's a direct reflection of some mixed macroeconomic signals we've been hearing about.
That's exactly right. It mirrors the broader economic picture quite well.
How so? What's the broader economic picture that this rail data connects to?
Well, you look at the U.S. labor market, for instance. It remains a real pillar of strength. Steady job gains, low unemployment rate, that's supporting the economy.
Right.
But as the intermodal data kind of hints at, this hasn't fully translated into continued goods consumption. Inflation-adjusted consumer spending on goods has actually slowed down a bit.
People are spending, but maybe not on physical stuff as much, or inflation's eating into it.
Something like that. Meanwhile, the manufacturing sector remains a key area of concern. The Institute for Supply Management's manufacturing PMI, that's been in contraction territory for the vast majority of the last 2 years.
So manufacturing weakness, that directly impacts a significant share of those rail carloads you mentioned earlier.
Precisely. Even though carloads are up year over year, that underlying manufacturing weakness is a worry.
And we can't forget inflation.
Right.
Still sticky.
Yeah. Stubbornly persistent. Still remaining above the Federal Reserve's 2% target. And that clouds the outlook for future monetary policy, interest rates, you know, the whole picture.
So how do the railroads track this internally? Is there a specific measure they use?
There is. The Association of American Railroads, the AAR, they have a specific metric called the Freight Rail Index, or FRI.
FRI. Okay, what does that measure?
It aggregates data on economically sensitive freight. So it pulls together things like chemicals, metals, forest products. But it specifically excludes the more volatile coal and grain categories to give a clearer picture of the core industrial economy.
Got it. So it smooths out some noise. And what did the FRI tell us in June 2025?
The FRI fell in June 2025. And that was driven primarily by the softness we saw in intermodal volumes.
Ah, so it confirms that potential slowdown on the consumer side of the economy.
Exactly. As a leading indicator of economic momentum, the FRI's recent performance suggests that while the industrial backbone, the carload side, is holding firm for now, the rail industry, and maybe by extension the broader economy, will likely continue navigating these challenging crosscurrents. This economic tug of war, it directly impacts the cost and availability of goods you rely on every day.
Okay, so we've got these crosscurrents, these mixed signals, but beneath it all, the rail industry has always been seen as incredibly stable, right? A foundational piece of our economy.
Absolutely. It's bedrock.
And a big part of that stability comes down to its unique market structure. You called it a classic oligopoly. For those who might not know, what exactly is an oligopoly?
Yeah, an oligopoly is basically just a market where a small number of large firms dominate. Think major cell phone carriers, maybe, or the big airlines.
Okay, just a few players calling the shots.
Exactly. There aren't dozens of competitors, just a handful. And what one does instantly impacts the others. That's precisely how North American freight rail operates.
And the structure didn't just happen overnight.
No, not at all. It's a result of over a century of consolidation. A process that really picked up speed after the Staggers Rail Act of 1980, which partially deregulated the industry.
Right. Deregulation often leads to consolidation. And that consolidation has been pretty dramatic, hasn't it? Going from dozens of railroads down to just a handful today.
Oh, incredibly dramatic. In the mid-20th century, there were dozens of what we call Class I railroads. Today, that landscape has condensed to just 6 major freight carriers.
6? Who are they?
You've got BNSF Railway and Union Pacific mainly in the west. Then CSX Transportation and Norfolk Southern mainly in the east. And the two Canadian players, Canadian National or CN, and the newly formed Canadian Pacific Kansas City, CPKC.
Just 6 giants.
Yeah.
Does that concentration of market power create concerns, like maybe limited options for shippers?
That's always the tension, right? Historically, the industry has seen periods of intense, even destructive price competition. Think back to the rate wars of the 19th century.
Yeah, yeah.
It got so bad it led to instability, bankruptcies, even cartels. And eventually it led to the formation of the Interstate Commerce Commission, the ICC, way back in 1887. That was the first federal agency designed specifically to regulate an industry to ensure just and reasonable rates.
Okay, so fast forward to today. Direct price collusion is illegal, obviously.
Mm.
But you mentioned the oligopolistic structure still allows for rational pricing behavior.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? And what do they compete on now, if not just price?
Right. So direct collusion is out. But think about it. In an industry with only a few players, and where building a whole new railroad is, as we'll discuss, virtually impossible.
Right.
Engaging in a destructive price war where you slash rates so low that nobody makes money, that doesn't make sense for anyone. It's not rational.
Okay, so they avoid mutually assured destruction on price.
Pretty much. So instead, they compete fiercely on other things. Service quality, reliability, transit times, network reach, efficiency. Those become the key battlegrounds.
Got it.
But there's always that inherent tension. The railroads need to be profitable enough to fund these massive, ongoing capital investments in their networks, billions every year.
Yeah.
But the public and the shippers have an interest in competitive pricing. And that tension is primarily managed today by the Surface Transportation Board, or STB, the successor to the ICC.
The STB. We'll definitely come back to them.
And what's really fascinating here is how these nearly insurmountable barriers to entry ensure the stability of this oligopoly. They protect the incumbents and allow them to generate the consistent cash flows they absolutely need for their capital-intensive networks.
You said building a new railroad is virtually impossible. And earlier, you used the word inconceivable. That's strong language. What makes it so impossible for a new player, a new class one, to just emerge?
It really is inconceivable today. First off, there's just extreme capital intensity. The sheer cost of building a new railroad from scratch is staggering.
That's staggering.
You're talking about acquiring vast tracts of contiguous land, which is incredibly hard, then grading the terrain, laying thousands of miles of track, building bridges, tunnels, yards, terminals,
right.
And then you have to buy a massive fleet of locomotives and specialized rail cars, just to give you some perspective. The existing Class I railroads, the Big Six, collectively invest over $23 billion annually.
$23 billion a year.
Just for maintenance and upgrades on their existing networks, not building new ones. Union Pacific alone has invested something like $34 billion into its network over the past decade.
Wow. Okay, so the capital cost alone is astronomical. That's barrier number one. What else?
Barrier number two, land and right-of-way. The historical development of the rail network, you know, it was often aided by federal land grants back in the 19th century.
Right.
That created a physical footprint that is simply impossible to replicate today. Imagine trying to assemble the necessary property rights, dealing with all the environmental reviews, the zoning laws, crossing existing infrastructure. Building a new transcontinental line today would be a legal and logistical nightmare. Decades, maybe, if ever.
Okay, so capital and land are huge hurdles. What about network effects? That's something we hear about in tech, but it applies here too.
Absolutely. Hugely important. The value of a railroad is directly proportional to the size and reach of its network. An established carrier like UP or BNSF serves thousands of customers across hundreds of markets. And crucially, they have interchange agreements with all the other railroads. This creates a seamless transportation product for shippers. A new entrant, starting with zero customers and zero connectivity. They'd be an incredibly unattractive option. Who would ship with them if they can't reach anywhere else?
Makes sense. What else?
Then you have economies of scale and density. Railroad economics are heavily dependent on achieving high traffic density over those fixed assets. The high fixed costs of building and maintaining the network mean that profitability increases dramatically as you add more volume, more trains, more cars onto the tracks.
So the incumbents, with their established traffic, just have a massive cost advantage per unit moved.
Exactly. A huge cost advantage over any potential new entrant trying to build volume from scratch.
So it's not just the physical infrastructure, but also the established relationships, the volume, and the operational complexities.
Precisely. There are significant institutional and operational hurdles, too. Even if you could somehow overcome the physical and financial barriers, a new company would face immense operational challenges. Getting the cooperation of existing carriers for interchange traffic, that would be tough. Navigating the complex web of industry standards, safety regulations, labor agreements, incredibly difficult.
So these barriers combined explain why the industry is so stable, why it's such a foundational part of the economy, and why these companies can generate those consistent cash flows needed for their infrastructure. It's a deep moat.
One of the deepest economic moats you'll find anywhere.
That certainly paints a picture of an industry with an incredibly strong moat.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Surface Transportation Board, the FTB, manages the tension between profitability and public interest. Let's talk more about their role, especially as the gatekeeper for mergers.
Right, the STB. They are the primary federal agency in charge of economic regulation for U.S. freight rail. They succeeded the old ICC, as we mentioned, and they have exclusive jurisdiction over critical matters. Rates, service quality, line construction, abandonments. And most importantly for our discussion today, railroad mergers and acquisitions. They hold the keys to any consolidation.
And the STB's approach to mergers has really evolved over time, hasn't it? It wasn't always so restrictive.
No, it definitely evolved. For decades after the Staggers Act deregulated things in 1980, the STB, or rather its predecessor, the ICC, approved a series of mergers that steadily consolidated the industry.
But then something changed.
Yeah, things got bumpy. There were significant service disruptions that followed the Union Pacific-Southern Pacific merger back in 1996. Major meltdown in some areas.
I remember hearing about that. Gridlock.
Exactly. And that led the STB to adopt a much more cautious approach. In 2001, they established new, significantly more stringent rules specifically for major railroad mergers. That means mergers involving two or more Class I carriers.
More stringent how? What was the change?
Under these new 2001 rules, applicants didn't just have to show that a merger was in the public interest. They also had to demonstrate that the merger would actually enhance competition.
Enhance, not just preserve.
Enhance! That's a much, much higher bar than simply preserving the existing level of competition or arguing it wouldn't harm competition. You had to prove it would make things more competitive.
So those 2001 rules effectively put a freeze on major consolidation.
Yeah.
Involving the biggest players for two decades.
Pretty much, yeah. It essentially froze the map for the big Class I to Class I mergers. But then came what seems like a real game changer in 2023 with the CPKC approval.
Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern? How did that get through under those tough rules?
Yeah, well, the STB actually reviewed that transaction under the pre-2001 rules. They granted Kansas City Southern, KCS, a waiver.
Why the waiver?
Primarily because KCS was by far the smallest of the Class I railroads, and the combination was considered an end-to-end merger, meaning CP and KCS networks didn't really overlap much. They connected more like Lego bricks end-to-end.
Okay, so less direct competition was eliminated.
Right, and the board reasoned that this specific merger would actually create a new, stronger competitor overall. This combined CPKC could challenge the larger carriers, especially on north-south routes, and thereby enhance competition overall. That was the logic.
So even though they used the old rules, the reasoning echoed the spirit of the new rules enhancing competition. Here's where it gets really interesting. This decision seems to have set the stage for the industry's next and potentially final wave of consolidation.
It really did. It cracked the door open.
And that leads us directly to the seismic shift. The proposed Union Pacific Norfolk Southern merger announced in July 2025.
Indeed. This is the big one. A transaction with an enterprise value around $85 billion. This proposed acquisition would be the ultimate test of the modern STB's merger policy under those stringent 2001 rules.
Because this isn't small KCS, this is two giants.
Two absolute giants. And the goal, to create the first truly seamless transcontinental railroad in U.S. history.
A seamless transcontinental railroad. What's the vision behind that? What are UP and NS arguing?
The vision is a massive network. The combined entity would have over 50,000 route miles spanning 43 states with an enterprise value north of $250 billion.
Huge.
The applicants, UP and NS, they argue the combination will significantly enhance service. They say it will dramatically reduce transit times by eliminating those time-consuming, often congested interchange points between the eastern and western networks, particularly in places like Chicago.
So faster, smoother service across the country.
That's the pitch. And they also argue it'll create a more formidable competitor to both the trucking industry and the Canadian railroads, especially the expanded CPKC and CN.
Makes sense from their perspective. But what about the concerns? Shippers, competitors, they must have issues.
Oh, absolutely. You can expect significant concerns to be raised about reduced competitive options. If you're a shipper served by both UP and NS today, you might lose a competitor. That's the core worry.
So the STB has a massive decision on its hands.
Huge. It will involve a lengthy, rigorous review process, multiple years probably. Their decision, whatever it is, will fundamentally reshape the North American competitive landscape.
You mentioned earlier this idea of a stable four-railroad map historically. Two in the West, two in the East, plus the Canadians. This UPNS proposal completely blows that up.
Completely. For over two decades, that four-railroad system defined the U.S. map. UP and BNSF out West, CSX and NS in the East. The Canadians, CNNCP, now CPKC, providing that crucial north-south and cross-border connectivity. The STB's 2001 rules were the main reason for that prolonged stability.
So the CPKC approval really was the critical shift. It showed a path, maybe.
It did. By approving CPKC under the older rules, but emphasizing its end-to-end nature and how it created a new competitive force, the STB signaled that maybe, just maybe, other transformative combinations could be possible if they could be framed convincingly as pro-competitive.
And UP and NS clearly think they have that pro-competitive argument.
They do. They're framing it not just as a horizontal merger eliminating a competitor, but as the creation of a vertically integrated coast-to-coast network offering a superior single-line service product. The core argument to the STB will be this new, bigger entity can compete much more effectively against trucks and against CPKC and CN for the flow of goods across the entire continent.
And that move forces a strategic reckoning for the other players, right? BNSF and CSX.
Absolutely. This raises an important question. Does this pressure make a responsive combination between BNSF and CSX not just possible, but strategically necessary for them to maintain competitive parity?
If UPNS happens, could BNSF and CSX afford not to merge?
That's the multi-billion dollar question. They'd face the prospect of competing against a single, seamless transcontinental network that offers faster transit times, simpler pricing, no interchange delays. That's a huge disadvantage.
So the likely result, if UPNS goes through, is the end of that traditional four-railroad map.
It seems very likely. Instead, you'd see a new era, probably defined by two dominant U.S. transcontinental systems, UPNS and potentially BNSF-CSX, competing head-to-head across the country. Alongside them, you'd have the two distinct north-south networks of Canadian National and CPKC.
Wow. So this isn't just some big corporate deal. It's a fundamental restructuring of how goods move across North America.
Yeah.
With profound, long-lasting implications for supply chains, for costs, for every product you buy.
Exactly. It's redrawing the logistics map of the continent.
That's a huge shift in the competitive landscape.
Yeah.
To really understand it, we need to know who these major players are. You mentioned six Class I carriers. First, quickly, what officially defines a Class I carrier?
Yeah, it's a revenue threshold set by the Surface Transportation Board. Currently, it's annual operating revenues of $1.07 billion or more. After the CPKCS merger, there are now exactly six major freight carriers that meet this definition in North America. Plus Amtrak, the passenger carrier, but we're focused on freight.
Got it. Six freight giants. And you said each has a unique network and strategic focus defined by its geography. Let's spotlight each one. Let's start with Union Pacific, ticker UNP. They're driving this big merger proposal. What's their footprint and strategic edge?
Union Pacific operates the largest network in the United States by route miles, a formidable 32,693 miles. It primarily covers the western two-thirds of the country.
Okay, big western presence.
Huge. And their premier strategic asset, arguably, is their unparalleled access to Mexico. They are the only railroad to serve all six major rail gateways between the U.S. and Mexico.
All six? Wow.
Yeah, places like Laredo, El Paso, Nogales, they're at all of them. This positions them perfectly to capitalize on the growth in nearshoring manufacturing to Mexico and the overall USMCA trade.
That Mexico access is a huge differentiator then. Anything else notable about UP?
They're also seen as a leader in leveraging technology, things like AI and machine learning, for operational efficiency. And as we've discussed, they're the driving force behind the proposed transcontinental merger with Norfolk Southern.
Okay. How about BNSF Railway? UP's primary competitor in the West. They're private, right?
That's right. BNSF is privately held by Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company. They operate a slightly smaller but comparable network of 32,500 miles that directly competes with Union Pacific across 28 states in the western, midwestern, and southern U.S., plus parts of Canada.
What are their strengths?
Their northern and southern transcontinental routes are among the most important freight corridors globally. BNSF is the clear market leader in U.S. intermodal transportation. They have fantastic routes connecting key West Coast ports like Los Angeles and Long Beach directly to the major hub in Chicago.
So, king of intermodal.
Largely, yes. They're also a dominant agricultural carrier, moving massive amounts of grain. And being private under Berkshire arguably allows them to take a very long-term approach to investment without the quarterly pressures of public markets.
And the proposed UPNS merger. That hits them hard.
It presents the most significant strategic challenge to BNSF's competitive position. They'd be the ones facing that seamless transcontinental competitor most directly.
Okay, moving east now. We have CSX Transportation, ticker CSX. What defines their network?
CSX operates an approximately 20,000-mile network, heavily concentrated in the eastern U.S. They serve 23 states, the District of Columbia, and two Canadian provinces. Their network connects basically every major metropolitan area in the east, where nearly two-thirds of the U.S. population lives.
Big eastern reach, lots of population centers.
And lots of ports. They provide access to over 70 ocean, river, and lake ports. They essentially form a duopoly with Norfolk Southern in the east. And interestingly, showing some strategic agility, CSX has proactively partnered with the new CPKC Railroad. They've created something called the Southeast Mexico Express Service.
Ah, so they're already responding to the changing map.
Seems like it. A nimble move to get better access to that growing Mexico traffic via CPKC.
Okay. And their eastern counterpart, the other half of the duopoly, Norfolk Southern, ticker NSC.
Norfolk Southern operates a network very similar in size to CSX, nearly 20,000 miles, serving 22 states and D.C., primarily in the Southeast, East, and Midwest. They are the primary competitor to CSX across most of the eastern U.S.
What are their strengths?
Their franchise serves over half of the U.S. population and manufacturing base. They have a particularly strong merchandise franchise, think chemicals, metals, paper, and a significant presence in the automotive and intermodal markets as well.
And of course, their strategic importance right now is underscored by being the acquisition target for Union Pacific's transcontinental vision.
Exactly. They're the crucial eastern piece of that proposed puzzle.
Now to the Canadian players.
Yeah.
Canadian National, or CN, ticker CNI on the NYSE, They have a really unique network, don't they?
They absolutely do. CN possesses arguably the most unique geographic footprint of any Class R railroad. Its network is around 20,000 miles, but it's the only one that is tricoastal.
Tricoastal, meaning?
Meaning it connects the Atlantic coast of Canada, the Pacific coast of Canada, and the U.S. Gulf Coast. Think Halifax to Vancouver to New Orleans, all on one railroad.
Wow, that's an irreplicable asset.
Totally. It provides seamless single-line service for moving Canadian natural resources like lumber, potash, oil down to U.S. and global markets. And also for moving U.S. imports and exports up through efficient Canadian ports like Prince Rupert or Vancouver. CN was also an early pioneer of precision scheduled railroading, PSR.
Okay. And finally, the news class eye on the block. Canadian Pacific Kansas City, or CPKC, ticker CP. They're the poster child for this new wave of consolidation.
Indeed. CPKC was officially formed in April 2023 through that merger of Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern. They operate a roughly 20,000-mile network combined.
And their whole reason for being?
The entire strategic rationale for CPKC's existence is its status as the first and only single-line railroad connecting Canada, the United States, and Mexico.
The NAFTA Railway, or USMCA Railway now.
Exactly. This transnational network offers shippers a seamless transportation product for goods moving all along that crucial USMCA trade corridor, eliminating border interchanges and the associated delays and costs. This positions them perfectly to directly capture growth from that near-soaring trend, manufacturing moving to Mexico. They've already launched new services like the Mexico Midwest Express or MMX.
So what does this all mean? Each of these six players has a unique geographic advantage, a unique strength. And the proposed changes, especially the UPNS deal, affect them all very differently. It really underscores their strategic importance when you look at the sheer scale, the thousands of miles of track, the billions in revenue.
Absolutely. These are massive, strategically vital entities.
But they don't exist in a vacuum, do they? They're constantly interacting with other players, competitors on the highway, partners on smaller rail lines. Let's explore that broader ecosystem.
That's right. While these six large carriers dominate the landscape, it's crucial to understand how they interact with other modes of transport, particularly trucking, and also the vital role played by smaller railroads, and ultimately how geography dictates their long-term value.
Let's start with trucking. You mentioned the most dynamic competitive arena for railroads is intermodal, where they go head-to-head with trucks for long-haul freight.
Exactly. Intermodal, moving those shipping containers and truck trailers on rail cars for the long haul, with trucks doing the pickup and delivery at the ends, has become the largest single source of revenue for U.S. freight railroads.
It sounds like a natural partnership, really. Leveraging the strengths of both modes, rail for the long, efficient part, trucks for the flexible start and finish.
That's precisely the idea, and this growth is built on some powerful, enduring advantages that rail offers in this competition.
Like efficiency.
First and foremost, efficiency. On average, railroads are 3 to 4 times more fuel efficient than trucks. That's a huge difference.
3 to 4 times, wow.
Yeah. It translates directly into lower operating costs, especially when fuel prices are high. A single intermodal train can move 1 ton of freight over 470 miles on just a single gallon of fuel.
That's incredible. It really makes you think, next time you're stuck in highway traffic behind a long line of trucks, a significant chunk of that freight could potentially be moving much more efficiently on the rails.
Absolutely. Quieter, less congestion, more efficient. And that superior fuel efficiency translates directly into environmental benefits, too. A smaller carbon footprint.
How much smaller?
Moving freight by rail instead of truck can reduce greenhouse gas emissions by up to 75%. That's becoming a really powerful selling point.
Especially with shippers facing pressure on sustainability, ESG mandates.
Exactly. As companies focus more on their Scope 3 emissions, the environmental benefits of rail are a major draw. And finally, there's the broader societal impact.
Like getting trucks off the road.
Yeah. A single double-stack intermodal train can effectively remove several hundred long-haul trucks from the nation's highways. That eases congestion, reduces road wear and tear funded by taxpayers, and it helps alleviate the pressure from the chronic shortage of long-haul truck drivers we keep hearing about.
So the advantages seem pretty clear. Efficiency, environmental, societal.
Yeah.
But it's not a guaranteed win for rail every time, is it? It often comes down to that battle of price versus service.
It's a constant balancing act. Rail is generally most cost competitive on longer haul routes, typically over 500 to 750 miles.
Why that distance?
Because on those longer lanes, rail's lower line haul cost per mile becomes significant enough to offset the extra costs involved with intermodal. You've got the drayage, the short trek moves to and from the rail terminals, and the cost of lifting the containers on and off the train at both ends.
Okay, so there are extra handling costs, but over long distances, the line haul savings win out.
Usually. However, in the current economic environment of mid-2025 that we discuss, the trucking market is experiencing excess capacity. Lots of trucks chasing not enough freight.
Right, which drives truck rates down.
Exactly. Truckload rates have fallen substantially, and that has narrowed the price gap between truck and rail intermodal, making trucking more competitive, especially on those shorter long-haul lanes, and putting some pressure on intermodal volumes.
So that softness we saw in June intermodal's figures ties back to cheap trucking.
That's definitely a big factor right now. But it's important to remember this is likely a cyclical phenomenon. As the freight market eventually tightens up again and truck rates inevitably rise, the economic advantage should swing back decisively in favor of rail for those longer hauls.
Okay, so price is cyclical. What about service? Because, you know, shippers always say price is irrelevant if the goods don't get there reliably and on time.
Precisely. Consistency and predictability are paramount for shippers managing complex supply chains. And historically, this was rail's Achilles heel sometimes. In past years, when rail networks got congested and service levels dipped, shippers would pull their freight off the rails even if it cost more. They'd pay a premium for trucks just to ensure their production lines kept running and shelves stayed stocked.
So have the railroads recognized this? Have they improved?
Oh, absolutely. They've had to. They've used the operational discipline of precision scheduled railroading PSR that we'll talk more about to dramatically improve network velocity, fluidity, and service consistency.
So PSR isn't just about cost cutting.
No, a key outcome is better service. As one analysis we looked at noted, rail service, by many measures, has never been better than it is now. You're seeing improved fluidity, faster transit times in many lanes. This improved service product is absolutely the key to convincing shippers to make that long-term commitment, to really integrate rail structurally into their supply chains, not just use it when it's cheapest.
Okay, so the battle with trucking is crucial. But what about within the rail world? You mentioned the smaller railroads. How important are they?
Critically important. If we connect this to the bigger picture, these smaller railroads are absolutely vital. They literally connect countless businesses to the national and global supply chain.
Really? Even though the six class I's dominate the headlines?
Yes. The North American freight network is a complex ecosystem. It relies heavily on the contributions of over 600 short line and regional railroads.
600, wow. Mm-hmm. How much track do they operate?
They operate approximately 47,500 route miles. That accounts for nearly 30% of the total freight rail mileage in the United States. Almost a third of the track miles are operated by these smaller guys.
That's surprising.
Yeah.
So they're not just niche players. They make up a huge portion of the actual track infrastructure. What's their core function then?
Their primary, most critical function is providing that first mile and last mile service. Think of them as the capillary network feeding the main arteries.
Okay.
They act as the essential link between thousands of shippers, farmers, small manufacturers, producers, often located in rural areas or smaller towns, and the main lines of the Class I network.
So they originate and terminate a lot of freight.
A huge amount. In fact, roughly one in every five rail cars moving on the entire national system either originates or terminates on a short line.
One in five. That's significant.
Absolutely. Without these smaller carriers, countless businesses would effectively be cut off from accessing the national and global supply chain via rail. So short lines are vital engines of local economic development.
So they're symbiotic partners with the Class I railroads then? It's not really competition?
Very much a symbiotic relationship. The short lines gather freight from many smaller customers, maybe just a few carloads here and there, and they aggregate it into blocks of cars. These blocks are then efficiently handed off to a Class I carrier for the long-haul journey across the country.
So the short lines feed the class's traffic.
Exactly. This feeder system generates significant profitable traffic for the major carriers. And in turn, the Class I railroads provide the national and international reach that the short line customers depend on to get their goods to market.
Do the short lines have any other advantages?
Yeah. Due to their smaller size and intense local focus, short lines can often offer a level of flexibility and customized service that might be difficult for the huge Class I carriers to provide. They often fight hard for a single carload business with the same intensity a Class I might reserve for a 100-car unit train.
More nimble, maybe more customer-focused at that local level.
Exactly. And that entrepreneurial spirit has allowed the short line industry to thrive and grow significantly since deregulation. They went from maybe 8,000 miles of track back in 1980 to nearly 50,000 miles today, often taking over lines the Class I's wanted to abandon.
That's a great story. Okay, so we have the classes, the competition with trucks, the partnership with short lines. Let's wrap this section by coming back to geography. You said it's the ultimate differentiator.
It absolutely is, more than anything else in the long run. The competitive advantages and the long-term value of any railroad are overwhelmingly dictated by the unique geography of its network. Where its tracks go, who it connects, what resources it accesses.
So things like financial metrics, operational efficiency, they're important, but they're downstream from geography.
Exactly. They're critically important, but they are ultimately outcomes of the strategic positioning of a carrier's physical assets, of its map. And the recent and proposed mergers are the clearest possible illustration of this principle.
How so?
Well, look at CP's OC. The entire rationale for that merger, the $30-plus billion price tag, was to create that unique, irreplicable, single-line network connecting Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. That specific geography is the value proposition, positioning the new company to directly capture the growth in USMCA trade.
Right, geography-driving strategy. And the Union Pacific Norfolk Southern proposal. Same principle.
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
Union Pacific's pursuit of Norfolk Southern is a direct attempt to solve what they see as the largest structural geographic inefficiency in the U.S. rail system. That time-consuming and costly interchange of traffic between separate eastern and western carriers in congested hubs like Chicago.
So the strategic prize is geographic.
Yeah.
A seamless coast-to-coast service network.
Precisely. A service that no competitor can currently offer. And even among the established carriers, their key differentiators often come down to network geography. We mentioned CN's unique tri-coastal network, giving it access to three oceans.
Right.
And Union Pacific's dominance at all six Mexico gateways gives it a distinct geographic edge over its western rival, BNSF, in capturing that lucrative cross-border market. So it's not just about trains running on tracks. It's about strategically valuable land, routes, and connections that facilitate continental and global trade. Geography is destiny in this business.
That's a great segue into the financial engine that drives these geographic strategies. And an industry so focused on efficiency, especially with PSR, the operating ratio or OR, seems paramount. Can you explain what that is and how PSR has impacted it?
Yeah, absolutely. In the railroad industry, the single most scrutinized metric of operating performance is the operating ratio, the OR. It's simply calculated as operating expenses expressed as a percentage of revenue.
Okay, expenses divided by revenue. So a lower OR is better.
What exactly? A lower OR signifies greater efficiency and profitability. Less of each revenue dollar is being spent on operations. And the widespread adoption of precision scheduled railroading, or PSR, over the past decade or so has led to a really dramatic and industry-wide improvement in this key metric.
How did PSR achieve that?
By focusing relentlessly on optimizing assets, running fewer, longer trains, improving locomotive and car utilization, reducing dwell times in yards, and frankly, controlling costs, including headcount in some areas.
That makes sense. And looking at the operational data, it seems like clear performance tiers have emerged among the Class I railroads based on their OR.
Yeah, you can definitely see different levels of performance. Canadian National and Canadian Pacific, and now CPKC, have historically been the industry leaders in efficiency, consistently posting ORs down at or even below 60%. Really lean operations.
60% or less.
Okay.
What about the U.S. carriers?
Union Pacific has made significant strides recently. They've brought their OR down from maybe the mid-60s a few years ago to a record 59.9% in 2024. That really demonstrates successful execution of their PSR-based strategy under their current leadership.
So UP is now playing in that top tier. What about the Eastern guys, CSX and Norfolk Southern?
The Eastern carriers, CSX and NS, have also undergone major PSR-driven transformations. And that's led to substantial improvements in their operating ratios as well. They've come a long way. But they still generally lag their Western and Canadian peers slightly in terms of the absolute OR number.
Okay, so the OR gives us that top-line efficiency number. But beyond just the OR, what other metrics show the impact of PSR and the overall operational health of the industry? Like, how do we know if the trains are actually running better?
Right, the OR is the result, but you want to see the underlying drivers. So we look at things like freight car velocity, literally how many miles per day the average freight car is moving across the network. Faster is better. And terminal dwell, that's how long, on average, a car sits idle in a yard waiting to be switched or put on another train. Shorter is better.
Got it. Velocity up, dwell down. Like a sports team, you want them running plays fast, not stuck in the huddle.
Exactly. Improvements in these metrics, like UP reporting a 2% increase in freight car velocity in 2024, directly translate to better service for customers, faster transit times, and more efficient use of those very expensive capital assets, the locomotives and cars.
Makes sense.
Any others? Yeah, locomotive productivity has improved across the industry as PSR principles have enabled carriers to move more freight with fewer but often longer trains. And then there's pricing power.
Yes, the benefit of that oligopoly structure.
Right. It's evident in the carrier's ability to consistently increase revenue per carload, often above the rate of inflation, even after you exclude the impact of fuel surcharges, which just pass through costs.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Union Pacific, for instance, noted in their 2024 results that strong core pricing gains helped drive a 4% increase in their freight revenues, even when you strip out the fuel component. That shows underlying price strength.
So it's all about getting more productivity out of the existing assets and maintaining price discipline. But this is also, as we've established, a highly capital-intensive business, requires massive investments just to stay operational, right?
Absolutely. That's the other side of the coin. Railroads have to continually invest billions with a B dollars each year just to maintain and upgrade their vast infrastructure. Track, bridges, signals, tunnels, plus the rolling stock, the locomotives, and cars.
What kind of numbers are we talking annually?
Well, in 2024, for example, Union Pacific's capital program totaled $3.4 billion. BNSF was even higher at $3.7 billion. These investments typically represent somewhere between 15 to 18% of their annual revenues, a huge chunk.
15 to 18% of revenue just plowed back into the business every year. That's intense.
It is, and given this enormous and continuous need for capital, probably the most important measure of long-term financial success isn't just the OR, but return on invested capital, or ROIC.
ROIC, explain that one.
ROIC measures how effectively a company is generating profits from all the capital it has deployed in the business, both debt and equity. It basically asks, for every dollar invested in the railroad, how much profit is it generating each year?
Okay. And higher is better here, too.
Definitely. A high and stable ROIC indicates a strong competitive advantage, that deep moat we talked about, and disciplined capital allocation by management. It shows they're investing that money wisely. In 2024, Union Pacific reported an industry-leading ROIC of 15.8%. That's a very strong return for such a capital-intensive business.
And all that efficiency, the PSR gains, the smart capital spending, ultimately, it should lead to strong free cash flow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what shareholders really care about.
Precisely. Free cash flow, or FCF, is the ultimate bottom line in many ways. It's the cash generated from operations after you've paid for all those necessary capital expenditures we just discussed.
The cash left over.
Exactly. And that's the lifeblood of shareholder returns. It's the cash that's available to fund dividends and share repurchases.
How much FCF do these guys generate?
It's substantial. In 2024, for example, Union Pacific generated $2.8 billion in free cash flow. Norfolk Southern generated $1.7 billion. The ability to consistently generate substantial free cash flow, even through economic cycles, is a hallmark of this industry and a key component of its investment appeal.
Okay, so putting this all together, the PSR improvements, the focus on metrics like OR and ROIC, the strong free cash flow, it sounds like the industry might be hitting a kind of strategic inflection point. It seems like the initial phase of PSR, which was maybe more heavily focused on cost cutting, might be largely complete. So what's next? Where does the focus shift now?
You're right. That's exactly the transition we're seeing. The initial implementation of PSR, maybe say from the mid-2010s onward for many, was primarily a cost-cutting and margin expansion story.
Right. Getting the house in order.
Yeah. Rationalizing assets, closing inefficient hump yards, maybe reducing headcount, running those longer trains. Carriers like CSX, NS, UP were able to achieve dramatic step change improvements in their operating ratios during that phase. But that phase of harvesting the sort of low-hanging fruit of efficiency gains, it's now largely complete for most of them.
Okay, so the big OR drops might be behind us.
Mostly, yes. Which marks this critical strategic inflection point. If you listen to management presentations or investor calls now, the conversation has clearly shifted. It's moved from an almost singular focus on cost reduction towards a more balanced approach.
Balanced out.
Balanced towards leveraging the newly efficient network to provide a superior service product and using that better service to drive top-line growth, volume growth, market share gains.
Ah, so it's moving from defense to offense.
That's a good way to put it. The goal is no longer just to run a cheaper railroad, but to run a better, more reliable railroad that can aggressively and profitably compete for market share, especially against trucks.
And the proposed UP&S merger seems to fit right into that new paradigm.
Perfectly. It exemplifies it. Yes, the deal projects significant annual cost savings, about $1 billion. But the real headline synergy they're pouting, it's the $1.75 billion in anticipated new revenue opportunities.
New revenue, not just cost cuts. Where does that come from?
Primarily from the benefits of that seamless single-line service. Faster transit times, more reliable schedules. They believe that will attract new business, particularly intermodal freight that currently moves over the highway or via less efficient rail interchanges.
So what does this all mean for investors, for observers? Where should they focus?
It means the industry's next chapter of value creation won't just be about cutting costs further. It will be about successfully translating those hard-won operational improvements into sustainable volume and revenue growth. Can they take that efficient machine and use it to win more business? That's the key question now.
So the companies are evolving from simply being efficient transporters to becoming maybe more like strategic supply chain partners, offering new, better solutions based on that efficiency.
Exactly. That's the goal, moving up the value chain.
That shift from pure cost cutting to a focus on growth powered by better service is a critical change. So what are the major growth drivers and strategic opportunities that the rail industry is now targeting to make that happen?
Well, the single largest growth opportunity by far is converting more freight from the nation's highways onto the railways.
Taking share from trucks.
Exactly. The long-haul trucking market is absolutely massive. It dwarfs rail freight in terms of total volume and revenue. Rail currently captures only a relatively small fraction of it, especially for merchandise and consumer goods. So the potential is huge.
And the value proposition for shippers to make that switch. We touched on it, but let's reiterate why it's so compelling, especially now with better rail service.
Right. It's multifaceted. First, back to fuel efficiency and cost. We said rail is roughly 3 to 4 times more fuel efficient than trucking.
Right. 470 ton miles per gallon.
That provides a significant cost advantage, particularly on those long haul routes, and especially when diesel prices are high. Yeah. Second, the environmental sustainability benefits.
Up to 75% reduction in greenhouse gases.
Which is increasingly critical for shippers trying to meet their ESG mandates and corporate sustainability goals. That's moving from a nice-to-have to a must-have for many companies managing your supply chains.
Good point. What else?
Then there are those significant societal benefits we discussed. Alleviating highway congestion, reducing road damage, and helping address the chronic shortage of long-haul truck drivers. Moving freight by rail just puts less strain on public infrastructure and the trucking workforce.
So the case seems strong, but you said the key to unlocking all this opportunity is service.
Absolutely. Service, service, service. To convince shippers to switch from the inherent flexibility of trucking, where they can maybe get a truck dispatched on short notice, railroads must provide a consistent, reliable, predictable service product, something that feels almost truck-like in its reliability.
And the operational improvements driven by PSR are making this more of a reality now.
That's the claim, and increasingly the reality in many lanes. Better network fluidity, faster transit times, more dependable schedules. That's what gives railroads the credibility to go after that truck competitive freight.
And intermodal seems to be the primary vehicle, the main tool for capturing this freight from trucks. Is that where we should expect the biggest surge?
Yes. Intermodal is definitely poised for continued long-term growth. It's the main way rail competes for merchandise and consumer goods. And it's driven by several powerful underlying trends.
Like what?
Well, the long-term growth of international trade, particularly imports from Asia, drives huge volumes through West Coast ports like Long Beach, Seattle-Tacoma, Vancouver, Prince Rupert.
Right.
And much of that cargo gets transferred directly onto intermodal trains for distribution across the continent. The rise of e-commerce has also been a massive tailwind, increasing demand for the efficient long-haul movement of consumer goods from ports and domestic factories to inland distribution centers closer to consumers.
So railroads are investing heavily to handle this intermodal growth.
Billions of dollars. They're expanding intermodal capacity constantly. That includes building new inland terminals, like giant logistics parks far from the coasts. They're also investing heavily in on-dock or near-dock rail capabilities at major seaports to streamline that transfer of containers directly from ship to train, cutting out trick moves.
Any specific examples?
Sure. BNSF, the intermodal leader, has major expansion projects like at their Cicero terminal near Chicago, and they're developing a huge planned facility called the Barstow International Gateway out in the California desert, designed specifically to handle growing import volumes more efficiently further inland.
And technology must play a role too, making those terminals work faster.
Huge role. New automated gate technologies, optical scanning systems, they're speeding up truck processing times dramatically at intermodal terminals. That reduces congestion inside the yard and, crucially, improves turn times for the drayage drivers, the truckers who shuttle containers between the rail yard and the customer. Making life easier for them is key to the whole system working smoothly.
Okay, so converting freight from trucks via improved intermodal service is growth driver number one. What's another major opportunity?
Cross-border trade, particularly under the USMCA agreement, north-south trade.
The new NAFTA. How big is this opportunity?
It's viewed as a premier secular growth opportunity. It's being driven by the strengthening of North American supply chains, companies wanting more resilience, and especially that trend of nearshoring manufacturers moving production out of Asia, perhaps, and relocating it to Mexico to serve the U.S. market more closely.
And this trend is so powerful, it's actually driven the biggest strategic moves in the industry recently.
Exactly. It's no coincidence, the creation of CPKC. That merger was executed for the express purpose of creating that single-line rail network connecting all three USMCA nations. That unique Canada-US-Mexico franchise allows CPKC to offer a seamless service for goods moving from manufacturing centers in Mexico all the way up to consumer markets in the US Midwest and Canada. It's a powerful competitive advantage designed specifically for this trend.
And the Union Pacific bid for Norfolk Southern. That also has a big USMCA angle.
Absolutely. A primary strategic rationale presented for combining UP and NS is to create a much more effective competitor for this growing north-south traffic. The idea is the merged entity could connect Union Pacific's dominant six Mexico gateways directly, seamlessly, to the industrial and consumer heartland of the eastern U.S. served by NS. That would unlock new, faster, more efficient routes for cross-border freight compared to today's interchanges.
So what's fascinating here is how these huge multi-billion dollar strategic moves by the industry's largest players clearly signal that they expect USMCA trade, particularly with Mexico, to be a primary engine of rail volume growth for the foreseeable future. They're placing massive bets on it.
Huge bets. They see it as a long-term secular tailwind.
And to capitalize on all these growth opportunities intermodal, USMCA railroads need to keep investing in their actual networks, right? Adding capacity.
Continuously. They are constantly investing to increase capacity, improve fluidity, eliminate bottlenecks. These aren't just random projects. They're typically carefully selected investments designed to provide attractive returns on invested capital by enabling more traffic flow.
What kind of projects are we talking about?
Things like adding sections of second, third, or even fourth mainline track in high-density corridors. BNSF, for example, has been working for years on double and triple tracking large portions of its southern Transcon route between California and Chicago.
Okay.
Lengthening sidings on single track lines so longer trains can pass each other without stopping. Optimizing yards and terminals, maybe reconfiguring tracks, adding automated cranes for intermodal lifts, improving gate systems, and upgrading bridge and tunnel clearances, which is crucial for allowing those tall double-stack intermodal trains to operate on more routes.
So these aren't just maintenance costs you have to spend. They're strategic investments designed specifically to capture that future demand from intermodal and USMCA trade and to make the entire system more efficient and, by extension, more environmentally friendly, enabling that growth.
Exactly. It's building for tomorrow's freight.
So we've talked about the immense opportunities, the fundamental strengths, the strategic shifts towards growth. It sounds pretty positive. But, you know, no sector is without its challenges. What are the key risk factors, the potential bumps in the tracks, that investors and observers really need to be aware of with the rail industry?
Yeah, it's definitely not all smooth sailing. The biggest, most obvious risk is economic sensitivity. The industry's fortunes are just inextricably linked to the health of the broader economy.
Because they haul everything.
Exactly. They haul the fundamental building blocks of economic activity, raw materials, industrial products, consumer goods, grain, coal, cars, you name it. So rail volumes are highly correlated with broad economic indicators like gross domestic product, GDP, and industrial production.
Which means recessions hit hard.
They do. Cyclical downturns are a significant risk. A recession or even just a significant economic slowdown would almost certainly lead to a broad-based decline in freight volumes across nearly all commodity segments. And because the industry has such high fixed costs, maintaining that huge network doesn't get much cheaper when volumes drop, this operational deleverage can lead to really sharp declines in profitability during downturns.
And certain industries they serve are more cyclical than others, right?
Yes.
Which impacts specific rail segments more.
Exactly. Railroads have heavy exposure to inherently cyclical sectors like manufacturing, housing construction, and automotive production. A slowdown in these areas directly impacts volumes of key commodities like steel, lumber, chemicals, plastics, finished vehicles, auto parts.
And that weakness in the ISM manufacturing PMI you mentioned earlier is a current example of this risk playing out.
It's a tangible illustration, yeah. That prolonged weakness signals caution for industrial volumes. Energy price fluctuations are another factor they have to navigate.
How so? You said fuel surcharges pass most costs through.
They pass through most of the direct cost of higher diesel prices for their locomotives, yes. But energy price volatility has a broader impact. For example, high natural gas prices can temporarily increase demand for coal shipments to power plants.
Okay.
But conversely, a sharp drop in oil prices can reduce shipments of crude by rail and also the frac sand used in drilling. And crucially, low diesel prices also lower the operating costs for their main competitors, the trucking industry, making trucks more price competitive against intermodal, as we discussed.
Right, that interplay with trucking costs. What about trade?
Trade volumes and policy are critical, especially for intermodal. A significant portion of rail traffic, particularly containers moving inland from West Coast ports, is tied directly to international trade flows. So a global recession that dampens imports, or major changes in trade policy like new tariffs or geopolitical disruptions that snarl shipping lanes, all those can have a direct and immediate negative impact on rail volumes.
Okay, so economic sensitivity is risk number one. What about regulation? This is a highly regulated industry.
Very much so. Regulatory and environmental risks are significant. The STB, the Surface Transportation Board, as we discussed, has the authority to regulate rates and service, particularly for shippers deemed to be captive, meaning they only have access to one railroad.
Market dominance cases.
Exactly. While the industry has been largely deregulated on pricing since the Staggers Act, the STB retains this market dominance jurisdiction. A more aggressive regulatory stance by the STB, perhaps under political pressure about prices, could limit the industry's future pricing power and potentially impact profitability.
And the outcome of the UPNS merger review falls squarely into this category.
Absolutely. That's a major regulatory risk right now. A flat-out rejection by the STB would obviously upend the strategic landscape. But even an approval that comes with really onerous conditions like major track divestitures to competitors or strip service requirements could significantly limit the deal's potential value for the railroads involved.
What about environmental regulations?
Railroads face a complex web of environmental laws. The most significant future risk is probably the potential for some form of carbon pricing or stricter greenhouse gas emissions standards down the road.
How would that impact them?
Well, it would likely increase their operating costs, maybe requiring investment in more fuel-efficient locomotives or alternative fuels. But interestingly, it would also likely improve rail's competitive position relative to the less fuel-efficient trucking industry. So it's a double-edged sword.
Interesting point. Any other environmental risks?
Regulations concerning the transport of hazardous materials are always a key area of focus and public concern. Any major derailment or incident involving hazmat can, understandably, lead to public pressure for stricter rules, higher insurance costs, and operational changes.
And safety regulations in general must be a big cost.
Huge. The industry is subject to stringent safety regulations from the Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA. Compliance with these rules, covering everything from track standards to crew hours to equipment safety, requires significant and ongoing capital investment. Think about the multi-billion dollar industry-wide mandate to implement positive train control, or PTC, over the last decade or so. That was a massive safety-driven cost.
Yeah, PTC was huge. What about labor?
Labor relations are a constant factor and a recurring risk. The railroad workforce is heavily unionized across multiple different craft unions. Collective bargaining negotiations are governed by a unique federal law, the Railway Labor Act, which is designed to prevent disruptions to interstate commerce.
But strikes can still happen.
They can, though it's rare for them to last long due to the economic impact. Negotiations can be contentious, protracted, and the potential for a work stoppage or strike during contract disputes is always there. A strike doesn't just disrupt the railroads, it can quickly cripple the entire national supply chain, often prompting federal intervention, even congressional action, to force a resolution.
Okay, so economic, regulatory, environmental, safety, labor. Quite a few risks. And one more thing. Unlike trucking companies that use public roads, railroads own their own infrastructure. That comes with a heavy burden, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. That's a key differentiator and a significant financial obligation. Railroads own, operate, and are solely responsible for maintaining their vast infrastructure network, the tracks, the bridges, the signals, the land.
Unlike trucking, which operates on publicly funded highways maintained by taxpayers.
Exactly. And this responsibility entails a massive and largely non-discretionary maintenance obligation. Every year, railroads must spend billions of dollars replacing worn-out rail, replacing millions of wooden ties, spreading fresh ballast rock, inspecting and repairing thousands of bridges and tunnels, maintaining complex signal systems, just to keep the network in a state of good repair and safe for operation.
So that 15-18% of revenue going to CapEx, a big chunk of that is just essential maintenance.
A very large chunk is maintenance capital, yes. And this creates that high fixed cost base we talked about. It also means there's a continuous, unavoidable need for capital, which can strain finances during periods of weak demand when revenues fall, but maintenance needs don't necessarily go away. It's a heavy, ongoing burden that trucking companies just don't have in the same way.
Given these massive capital requirements, the cyclical risks, the strategic shifts we've discussed, the quality of the management team and their capital allocation strategy must be absolutely critical for these companies. How they decide where to spend money seems paramount.
It's arguably the most critical factor for long-term investment success in this industry. For mature, incredibly capital-intensive businesses like railroads, a disciplined and shareholder-focused capital allocation strategy is everything.
What's the core challenge for management?
With the bulk of the major network expansion completed decades ago, the primary financial challenge for management today is to strike the right balance. They need to ensure sustained reinvestment back into the business, maintaining the network, investing in technology, funding growth projects, while also providing attractive returns back to shareholders. It's a constant balancing act.
Okay. And how do they typically return capital to shareholders? What are the main mechanisms?
Primarily through two channels, dividends and share repurchase programs.
Let's start with dividends.
All the publicly traded Class I Barkeriers pay a regular quarterly dividend. They generally target a sustainable payout ratio, meaning the percentage of their net income paid out as dividends, typically in the range of 35% to 45% over the long term through the ups and downs of the economic cycle. Consistent dividend growth is a key component of the total return proposition for owning rail stocks. Investors expect that dividend to grow over time.
Okay, so dividends provide that regular income stream. What about share buybacks?
Share repurchase programs are also a major component of their capital return strategies. Railroads tend to generate substantial free cash flow, as we discussed, often more than they need for dividends and immediate reinvestment.
Right.
So they use that excess cash to repurchase their own stock on the open market. This reduces the total number of shares outstanding, which has the effect of increasing earnings per share, EPS, for the remaining shareholders, and it can provide support for the stock price.
Are these buyback programs significant?
They can be quite substantial. For example, in 2024, Union Pacific repurchased $1.5 billion of its shares. And for 2025, they've publicly targeted spending $4.0 to $4.5 billion on repurchases. That's a lot of cash going back to shareholders via buyback.
Wow. But you mentioned M&A can affect that.
Yes. The decision to potentially pause share repurchases is a key consideration when undertaking large mergers or acquisitions. For instance, as part of the UPNS merger plan, management has indicated they anticipate a temporary halt to UP's buyback program after the deal closes. They'd need to focus that cash flow instead on paying down the debt incurred to finance the acquisition.
Ah, okay. So deleveraging takes priority over buybacks immediately post-merger. That leads to debt management. How do they handle the significant debt these companies carry?
Yeah, railroads definitely utilize debt capital, often issuing long-term bonds to help finance a portion of their large infrastructure and equipment investments. Maintaining a strong balance sheet and continuous access to the capital markets at attractive interest rates is absolutely essential for them.
So they aim for good credit ratings?
Definitely. The goal is always to maintain strong investment-grade credit ratings, typically in the A or BBB categories from agencies like Moody's and S&P. This ensures a low cost of capital and provides financial flexibility, especially during downturns.
What metrics do they and investors watch for debt levels?
A key metric is debt to EBITDA, total debt divided by earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. It measures how many years of earnings it would take to pay off the debt. For the proposed UPNS merger, for instance, the initial pro forma debt-to-EBITDA ratio is projected to be around 3.3x at closing.
Is that high?
It's higher than UP's current level, reflecting the debt taken on for the deal. But they've explicitly stated a commitment to rapidly deleverage using free cash flow to pay down debt back towards a target of around 2.8x within about 2 years. That shows a focus on managing the post-merger balance sheet.
How else do they manage debt risk?
Smart management teams also aim to maintain a well-staggered debt maturity profile. They try to avoid having a huge amount of debt come due all in one single year, which could pose a refinancing risk if market conditions are bad at that time. They spread it out. And of course, analysts also look at other long-term obligations, like unfunded pension liabilities, when assessing the overall financial health.
Okay, so capital allocation, dividends, buybacks, debt management, it all comes back to the quality of the leadership making those decisions. How important is management quality itself in this industry?
This raises an important question. In a capital-intensive industry like this, with such long-lived assets and complex operations, the quality of the leadership team and their strategic vision are absolutely paramount to long-term investment success. You need seasoned operators at the helm.
What defines a quality management team in rail?
Well, interestingly, the current roster of Class I CEOs is largely composed of executives with deep, hands-on experience in implementing precision scheduled railroading. Many of them came up under or were disciples of the late Hunter Harrison, who really pioneered PSR at railroads like Illinois Central, CN, and CP.
So operational expertise is key. Can you give examples of leaders the market seems to respect?
Sure. The market generally has high confidence in someone like CPKC CEO Keith Creel. He was a protege of Harrison, worked closely with him, and is credited with successfully executing the complex integration following the KCS acquisition. Similarly, the return of Jim Vena, another Harrison disciple, to the CEO role at Union Pacific a couple of years ago was very well received by investors. They credit him with driving significant operational improvements during his previous tenure as chief operating officer there. And his bold strategic move now to acquire Norfolk Southern clearly demonstrates a decisive vision for reshaping the company and the entire industry. He's not afraid to make big bets.
So it's about their track record, their operational chops, and their strategic vision.
Yeah.
And beyond the CEO, how they allocate capital is a key judgment point.
Absolutely. The most important decisions management makes over the long term are how and where to allocate that scarce capital. A history of disciplined, high-return investments in the core network projects that actually improve efficiency or enable growth, coupled with a consistent and prudent approach to shareholder returns, that's the hallmark of a high-quality management team.
And conversely, what are the red flags?
Things like value-destructive M&A overpaying for acquisitions that don't pan out. Or, conversely, a failure to invest adequately back into the core network, letting service quality slip to boost short-term profits, that can be very damaging long-term. Clear communication and transparency are also vital.
How so?
Effective management teams communicate their strategy clearly and consistently to investors. They set realistic financial targets, and they're candid about the challenges and risks they face. Investors hate surprises.
And finally, what about corporate governance? How does that play into assessing management quality?
Strong corporate governance structures are crucial for ensuring that management's interests are properly aligned with those of long-term shareholders. You want to see things like an effective board of directors composed primarily of independent outsiders with diverse skills and relevant experience who provide real oversight.
Okay. What else did them?
Executive compensation plans should be heavily weighted towards performance-based incentives, and those incentives should be tied to key long-term value drivers, things like sustained earnings per share growth, improvements in return on invested capital, and total shareholder return relative to industry peers, not just short-term metrics.
And maybe management owning stock themselves.
Yes, significant stock ownership by the management team and the board members is generally seen as a positive sign. It gives them skin in the game, aligning their personal financial interests directly with those of the public shareholders. And finally, just a fundamental commitment to transparent, clear, and conservative accounting practices is a cornerstone of good governance. At the end of the day, the people at the top of these companies are making multi-billion dollar decisions that will literally shape the physical infrastructure and the economy of North America for decades to come. Assessing their capability and alignment is critical.
This has been a truly fascinating deep journey into the North American rail industry. We've covered a lot of ground, from the economic signals to the competitive landscape, the financials, the risks, the management. As we wrap up, let's try to tie it all together. What's the overall investment thesis here? Where do the tracks ultimately lead for these companies and for investors?
Yeah, pulling it all together, the North American rail industry is undoubtedly at a major strategic crossroads right now. It presents a compelling but also quite complex opportunity for investors.
Compelling because of those foundational strengths.
Exactly. Its foundational strengths remain incredibly powerful. That oligopolistic market structure, the immense barriers to entry we detailed, the resulting inherent pricing power. These create that durable economic moat that underpins the industry's ability to generate substantial and consistent free cash flow, really through the entire economic cycle. That underlying stability is still there.
But it's also complex because of all the dynamic change happening.
Precisely. The industry is simultaneously in a state of profound dynamic change. This is being driven by two main forces. First, the maturation of that precision-scheduled railroading operating model. The big gains from initial implementation are mostly done. And second, this new and potentially final wave of transformative consolidation that's reshaping the entire map.
So the investment thesis has shifted. It's not just about who runs the tightest ship anymore.
Not just about that anymore, no. With PSR now effectively the industry standard, the key differentiator for future value creation, the thing investors need to focus on, will be the ability of these companies to leverage that hard-won operational efficiency into sustainable, profitable growth.
Growth in volume and revenue, not just margin expansion.
Exactly. Can they translate efficiency into growth? That involves providing a service product that's finally reliable and consistent enough to win significant durable market share back from the trucking industry. It involves capitalizing fully on those secular growth trends we identified, like intermodal and cross-border USMCA trade. And it involves continuing to make disciplined, high-return investments in technology and network capacity to support that growth.
And we've seen how the competitive landscape itself is being fundamentally reshaped by these forces.
Absolutely. The creation of CPKC has already established a unique North-South franchise that's perfectly positioned to benefit from nearshoring and USMCA trade. That's done. But the proposed merger of Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern, if it's approved by the STB, would be an even more seismic event.
Creating that first U.S. transcontinental railroad.
Right. And likely forcing a strategic combination of its primary rivals, BNSF and CSX, in response. This would usher in a completely new era, likely dominated by two massive coast-to-coast U.S. rail systems competing fiercely head-to-head for the nation's freight alongside the two distinct Canadian-based networks.
So in this rapidly evolving environment, how should investors assess the opportunities? What are the key factors?
You have to look closely at each company's specific network positioning, that crucial geography, their demonstrated operational prowess under PSR, their strategy for growth, and of course their current valuation in the market. What's fascinating here, again, is how these strategic moves are not just about grabbing market share from each other. They're about literally redrawing the map of North American logistics and positioning for future trade flows. It's a high-stakes game with decades-long implications.
Okay, so based on that framework, network, operations, growth, strategy, valuation, can we offer some thoughts on where the smart money might be looking for growth and value among the class I's right now? Sort of a ranking of the rails.
Yeah, we can offer some perspectives based on the analysis. Let's start with Canadian Pacific Kansas City, CPKC. We'd rate them a BUY.
Why CPKC?
They possess arguably the most compelling and unique growth story in the industry right now. That single-line network connecting Canada, the U.S., and Mexico is a one-of-a-kind strategic asset. It's directly aligned with those powerful secular trends of USMCA trade growth and nearshoring. As they integrate the CP and KCS networks and roll out new cross-border services, the growth potential is significant.
What about valuation? They seem expensive sometimes.
They do often trade at a premium valuation compared to peers, that's true, but arguably that premium is justified by their superior long-term growth prospects. The market is paying up for that unique strategic position.
Okay, CPKC a buy. What about Union Pacific, UNP?
Well, it offers a really compelling combination of factors, massive scale, proven operational excellence, and now a potentially transformative strategic catalyst.
Operational excellence from PSR.
Yeah. Under CEO Jim Venena, they've reestablished themselves as a leader in PSR execution, driving that operating ratio down near best-in-class levels. Their dominant franchise in the western U.S., plus that unparalleled access to all six Mexico gateways, provides a very strong foundation.
And the NS deal is the catalyst.
Exactly. The proposed acquisition of Norfolk Southern is a bold strategic move. If it's successful, it would create an unmatched transcontinental network with potentially substantial revenue and cost synergies. Now, the deal definitely carries significant regulatory risk and a long timeline.
Right.
But the potential reward is substantial. And importantly, even on a standalone basis without the NS deal, UNP's strong operating performance and what looks like a reasonable valuation make it an attractive investment in its own right.
Okay, so two buys, CPKC and UNP. What about the Eastern carrier, CSX Corporation, CSX?
For CSX, we'd lean towards a holding rating right now.
What? They're a good railroad.
Oh, absolutely. CSX is a high-quality, well-run railroad. They were one of the early successful PSR turnaround stories in the U.S. They have a strong franchise in the densely populated Eastern U.S., and they've shown that proactive strategic mindset with their CPKC partnership for Mexico access.
So what's the concern?
The main issue is the significant strategic uncertainty they face directly because of the proposed UPNS merger. If that deal happens, CSX, as the primary Eastern competitor, could be left at a significant competitive disadvantage against a seamless transcontinental UPNS.
Unless they combine with BNSF.
Right. A potential responsive merger between CSX and BNSF would be a logical and powerful countermove. It would create that second U.S. transcontinental system. But that outcome is purely speculative at this point. There's no guarantee it would happen or on what terms. So given that uncertainty, and with CSX's current valuation seeming pretty much in line with its historical averages, the risk-reward profile feels balanced right now. Hence, hold.
Okay, CSX a hold due to strategic uncertainty. What about the other Canadian giant, Canadian National, CNI?
We'd also rate CNI OLD.
Old. But they're one of the best run railroads with that unique tri-coastal network.
They absolutely are. CN remains arguably one of the best run railroads in North America. Operationally excellent, consistently strong returns on capital, and that unique tri-coastal network provides significant geographic diversification and resilience.
So why just hold?
In the current environment, compared to the others, its growth profile appears perhaps less dynamic. They don't have that direct catalyst like CPKC's Mexico integration or UP's potential NS transformation. Remember, CN actually tried to buy KCS themselves but lost out to CP. That left them somewhat on the sidelines of this current consolidation wave.
So a great company, but maybe lacks an immediate catalyst for outperformance.
That's the thinking. Its franchise is strong, no doubt, but it lacks that clear, transformative catalyst in the near term that could drive the stock significantly higher. And the stock currently seems fairly valued, reflecting its high quality and stable, but perhaps more modest growth outlook compared to some peers right now.
Okay. CNLold. And finally, Norfolk Southern, NSC, the target itself.
For Norfolk Southern, it's really a whole day as well, but for a very different reason. It's essentially a merger arbitrage situation now.
Meaning its stock price is tied to the deal.
Exactly. As the target of the proposed acquisition by Union Pacific, the investment case for Norfolk Southern stock is now primarily driven by the perceived likelihood of that deal closing and the spread between NSC's current stock price and the implied deal value.
Which was?
The implied deal value is around $320 per share based on the offer of $88.82 in cash plus 1.0 share of UNP stock for each NSC share. So NSC's stock will trade based on the market's calculation of the odds of the deal happening at that price, discounted by the time value of money and the risk it falls through.
So the standalone fundamentals of NSS, while improving, are less relevant now.
They're a secondary consideration for investors playing the merger. Given the significant regulatory hurdles the deal faces and the very long timeline to a potential closing, likely not before early 2027, there's considerable uncertainty. So unless you specialize in merger arbitrage, a hold rating seems appropriate. Let the deal play out.
That makes sense. So this analysis, looking at each player's unique position and the potential outcomes, really helps understand not just how the industry works today, but where the smart money might be looking for growth and value in this really foundational but rapidly changing sector.
Hopefully, yeah. It provides a framework for thinking about it.
We've really gone deep today. From the visible power of the trains themselves to the intricate economic signals, the operational strategies like PSR, the huge capital investments, the regulatory landscape, and these massive strategic merger battles that are reshaping the continent.
It's a lot to track, pardon the pun.
Huh, indeed. But it's clear the North American rail industry is literally building the supply chain of tomorrow. One track, one merger, one strategic decision at a time. The next time you see a freight train rumbling past, maybe consider not just the cargo it carries, but the vast continent it connects and the incredibly complex, evolving network it's a part of.
It's a vital, dynamic system hiding in plain sight.
So here's a final thought for you, our listener. What will you look for differently the next time you hear that train whistle blow?